So we went back over the, was it the 26th sutra or something? From the beginning again, we got about halfway through it, didn't we?
Yeah, we're actually almost done. We got quite a bit.
I think we got not too much further than we did the time before. Because we haven't gotten to the jhanas yet. By my bookmark. I got caught up reading the next one. I couldn't remember what the next one's about. Yeah, we're on page 263 by my book, which may or may not be 263 by your books. Yeah, it's like...
Yep, that's right.
Five more pages to go. Some sutras are only five pages.
My sense of five pages is just, I thought it was near the end, but you're right, it's smart. I've got it marked too.
And if you remember, this one is where the Buddha is describing. The last one, remember, it was about the different kinds of deer that get trapped by different hunters.
The bait.
The bait, yeah. And this one's about some monks who were interested in the Buddha, and they said they met was it Ananda that they met, or was it? Yeah, Ananda. They met Ananda, and they said, boy, it'd be really nice if the Buddha came and gave a talk. And so then later that day, the Buddha said to Ananda, let's go here, let's go there. And then Ananda said, well, there's a nice place just down the road that we could stay tonight. And, you know, seems as we've gone here or there, we could go thus. And there's some monks there. And then they were talking about the Buddha. Do you remember this part?
Mm-hmm.
They were talking about the Buddha when he came. So he waited outside until they stopped talking. Right, he coughed or something then. Yeah, he cleared his throat, very polite. And then they invited him in, and then he was asking them what they were talking about, and then he starts describing his experience. And this is one of coming to understand the difference between duality and unity, basically, which is called the difference between being caught in subject-object duality and the experience of transcendence. Which I was listening to Elaine Pagels, is that her last name, Pagel? The woman who has done all the different writings on the Gnostic Gospels. Mm-hmm. And
P-A-G-E-L?
Pagel, I think it is, yeah. And very interesting woman, and she's, this is her talks on the Gospel of Thomas, sometimes called the Hidden Gospel of Thomas, which a friend lent to me, and it was one of the early texts that my beloved teacher Ananda Bodhi taught us, the
Gospel of Thomas?
Yeah, the Hidden Gospel of Thomas, when it was found. Because it's such a mystical path, the teaching of it is so many parallels to Buddhism that it's really quite amazing. And Thomas actually taught in India.
Mm.
There are a very large group of Christians in India. But it's unlikely, I doubt, that his influence was Buddhist at that time. Even though there are so many parallels, and like a lot of people like to jump to that conclusion, it's just that the mystical path, whatever it is you're doing, you have to get to the point where the sense of self-grasping or separateness is no longer a refuge. But there has to be a sense of looking for something beyond satisfaction. Because satisfaction is always in terms of this self, for most of us, isn't it? But something that transcends satisfaction would be something that would be deathless. And satisfaction from how we understand it, is comes about from events, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If this happened and this happened and this happened, then I'd be satisfied. Don't we have that kind of definition of it?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. So the whole story that the Buddha is giving here, he's leaving out some things, but he's giving a particular teaching that's very suitable for monks. He's talking about how he went to different teachers and studied the jhanas. Do you remember that? Because he's not talking about so much about the worldly things. He's talking about how once he decided that he would be a meditator, he went to this teacher, and remember the first teacher he learned, what was it, the fifth jhana or the sixth jhana, do you remember that? It was Alara Kalama, and that's, I'm on page. Anyway, and then he went, but then he found out that that's it. Oh, and you want to check it? Good. I'm on page 257, and it would be probably footnote. In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. So it's footnote 301. So that would be the seventh jhana, because of fifth jhana is boundless space, sixth jhana is boundless consciousness, seventh jhana is no thingness or nothingness, and the eighth jhana is neither perception nor non-perception. Do you remember what jhana is, or do you want me to refresh you? I'm assuming you know. Okay, so jhana is basically a state of absorption where you can maintain your concentration on one point for very long periods of time. Now you know from your own experience that when you like music, don't you? When you're really listening to a beautiful piece of music and you're in the right mind state, you're totally focused on it and it makes you very happy, right? And other things may come and go, but you're not really particularly aware of them. So if you imagine concentrating that awareness, that one-pointedness, so that there wasn't even awareness of me and music, it would just be the total blissfulness of union. And then that went one more state to a state of just bliss without any kind of union or, you know. That would be called a formless jhana. There are four form jhanas and four formless jhanas, which one can practice. A very good way to start the practice of that is that blue flower. That, remember, I gave you all the blue flower a couple of retreats ago?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a very classical kind of one way, or working with the elements in the kasina form. These are ways where you can develop concentration and therefore jhana. And jhana is extremely useful for people who feel, addiction to what they would call in Buddhism a conceit, like either lack of confidence or overconfidence or equality consciousness and confidence. Does that make sense? Because there is this sense that there is an I who is always in a position. And for some of us, for all of us, some of the time, we're caught in that, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure out our position, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, I got a few nods. Okay, there's another. I get a nod from you too. Okay, so some of the time, all of us are caught in that. But a lot of the time, especially when we're really happy, like if you've ever rounded a corner and saw a deer giving birth or something,
mm-hmm.
you know, something that totally mm-hmm. opened you, there isn't any position there, is there? It's just awe, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very specific state, isn't it? there isn't really a subject-object happening there, right? So there is just a perception.
But is it not caused by you rounding the corner and that?
It's caused by your total focus.
Oh, of course.
Because
yeah.
It's total focus.
Of course, you could have rounded the corner.
All of your thoughts are totally interrupted by something totally unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happens in major trauma. But it's easier to see why it's blissful if it's not a trauma. That make sense?
Yes.
So jhana is all of the different ways of developing absorption to the point where you can develop absorption to the state that is called neither perception nor non-perception.
Do you know that state when you're in it?
Not when you're in it, but you know it when you come out of it. But each of those stages, there is a way to develop them that helps you know on your way in. You can see the signs that you're going in for this one.
Oh.
Like when you see boundless space, and then there's a particular... And in one of the sutras not too long from now, he talks about how you develop, how you change your focus and develop each of the other states. You know, from going from boundless space to boundless consciousness. That's the fifth and the sixth jhanas. Or the first two formless jhanas, depending on how you talk about it, right? So people who have a problem because they always feel like they're being watched or that they have to perform, either one, watch, then they're always criticizing themselves or they feel slightly uncomfortable. Or there's something supposed to measure up to, they have to perform because they feel like they're not seen somehow, you know? Who knows from what lifetime? It's like not important. But you know those ones that have to be equal because they have this sense that there's a certain, it's like a competition and we all have to be at a certain level, right? It's hard for them to believe or understand or comprehend what it's like to be present with consciousness without self-referencing. You can certainly appreciate that, can't you? Can you?
Yeah.
Can you? So if somebody is caught in a habit of always trying to see where they are in relation to others in position, is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Then it would be very hard for them to be able to understand a state beyond self because that habit would be so strong. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So for those people in particular, the Buddha would ask them to do jhana practice. When you experience jhana, you have a clear, specific, no questions about it, experience of being without a self. And it changes your comprehension. But then, you know, a lot of people, because it's very blissful and very nice, a lot of people, they just kind of stay there. So the first two teachers that the Buddha went to, they're like basically had achieved those last two jhanas. Right? But he went away from both of them because he realized that they were dependent on conditions and so therefore they were what?
Confirmed.
Yeah, he had to keep paying the electricity bill to keep them running. So therefore, they're still subject to dissatisfactoriness. And he really wanted to know, was there a state that wasn't... He saw what there was in it. There was no inherent self. And there was a clarity, and there was a joy, and there was an equanimity. You know, all those things were there. There wasn't any discursive thought, and there wasn't any need for any, and neither was there stupidity. The only thing that was missing was subject-object duality. So then he went further. And he went further, and then he talked about before he went through, and he sat underneath a tree, and he said this will serve for striving on page 259. Then, it being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage. So he's looking for something that doesn't depend on causes in order to come into being. Because he knows that a self is dependent on causes. No object, no subject. This is really interesting, isn't it? I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage. Being myself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, seeking the unaging supreme security from bondage, I attained the unaging supreme security from bondage. Being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the unailing supreme security from bondage, I attained the unailing supreme security from bondage, subject to death and so forth. I attained being myself subject to sorrow, understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, he attains it. And then subject to defilement, because the thing about the jhanas is that they begin to, at a certain point, they start to run down. You come out of them. Mm-hmm. The knowledge and then it says the knowledge and vision arose in me. And that basically is the brilliant line. My deliverance is unshakable. This is the last birth. Now there is no more renewal of being. Then he knew that he had awakened. And there's some things left out of this sutra that are in other sutras because he apparently spent about 6 weeks there playing around with awakening. And from that time, here came the teaching of what's called the Paticca-samuppada, or the dependent arising, and other very beautiful teachings in Buddhism. And then after about, I don't know whether it was 6 weeks or not, but that's the number that's coming to my brain. Then after that, then he thought, well, I should teach it, but there isn't anybody who could understand it. And then the Brahmin came, and remember that part? The Brahmin came and said, well, there might be a few beings with just a little dust in their eyes. Yeah. Maybe they can help you, right?
Yeah.
Maybe they can be the ones who can. So then he thinks about the two teachers that he had studied with, the one who taught him the seventh jhana and the one who taught him the eighth jhana. So we're about page 262 now. And so we're almost caught up with my little review, which I hope you found useful.
Yes.
And then he finds out that they died. And so neither one of them are able to receive the teaching because they have already passed into another realm. So, and then he remembered, which he doesn't talk about before in this sutra, but in other sutras he talks very much about the five bhikkhus that he practiced fasting. That he practiced fasting with, because before he had spent a lot of time deciding that how to work with desire, which I'm sure all of us have tried at least once in our lives, is just pretend it's not there. It's a really good idea. Yeah, just cut it off. Just turn cool.
Mm-hmm.
We've all done that, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
It's like adolescence is one of the better times to really perfect that, isn't it? You know, when you walk down the hall pretending you're cool. Your little heart's going to come. And so he thought, well, where are they? So then with the divine eye, he looked for them and he saw where they were, and so he started walking toward them. And that's as far as we got. We stopped at 263, right? At the teaching of the Dharma.
He goes from finding this agreeable piece of ground. It's like there's a step in between 17 and 18 that...
Yeah, he doesn't... I'm saying he isn't mentioning it here. In other sutras he talks about this. This sutra he's basically talking about to the bhikkhus, because they're meditators, about how the practice of jhana was very useful, but it caused him to see that he needed to bring insight into it. In fact, when we get to the end of this sutra, if my memory serves me correctly, we will find that what he is doing is very cutting short a lot of the things, not filling in the whole of the biography, but bringing together two things, that jhana and insight together are the path.
So he's not...
Or calm and insight. Whatever you want to call, or equanimity and awareness, whatever you want to call it. So basically, sometimes you see the seven factors of enlightenment taught, and mindfulness is in the center, and then three are called active and three are called passive. And so the active and the passive have to balance each other. Or the male and female have to become one. Or, you know, whatever mystical terms you want to use for it. I mean, it fits all the mystical teaching. Does that make sense? Is that useful? So
yeah.
That's what he's doing with this sutra. So he doesn't
go into the insight at all then, maybe.
Well, he will later.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Because he hasn't had any insight training. He's just had control training. Control desire. Or develop psychic powers.
Mm-hmm.
Or practice jhana.
Mm.
I mean, all the meditation teachers he worked with, that's what they've been teaching him.
So he had to discover the insight training for
himself? Well, his mind, which had a decent question, is insight training. Insight training is very straightforward. It's just a really good question. What's going on? But like really, not looking for an answer. You understand? Because
yeah.
Answer is still subject-object. But like insight is, what was your face before you were born? That's an insight question. Not who I am now or what I don't understand or what I don't know or who I'm happy with or who I'm unhappy with or, you know, whether I'm tired or whether I'm hungry, you know? Not those things. What was your face before you were born? If you give your flesh back to your mother and your bones back to your father, who are you then? Now it's pointing at something beyond subject-object, an identity beyond subject-object, which is why he calls himself the Tathagata, the thus gone, gone to thusness, totality, gone or come or being totality. Not subject-object. That's what Tathagata is. So it's called transcendent in Buddhism. It's called Christ in Christianity. As many names as you want to give it. Allah, whatever you want to call it. The blessed state in Judaism, it's the Messiah that is always about to come, always about to arise, and it's always present in your being and outside your being and above, below, in front, behind. But how to recognize it with calm and insight together? You have to turn around and look within and ask the right question. But when you're doing that, we all get distracted, don't we, by the thoughts and...
Yeah. They never quite.
And the doubts and the hopes and the fears and like actually just being present with a state of joy is very, like, not over the top joy, just like a willingness to be present, whether there's fear or illness or whatever. That's very hard, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, and some of us have trouble sitting for an hour every day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine anything I would like more, and especially the more I age, than to be able to just watch every moment with utmost respect and utmost curiosity. Just to be present in the experience of birth, death, death, birth, in every moment. That opens something in my heart that I find very precious, and that's why I love my Sangha. That's what my Sangha means to me. Because from my point of view, that's what we all want. You know, and I'm a egomaniac, so I decide that's what you want to. I'm very straightforward about that. Because there is something beyond self. There is a face before you were born. There is, if you're giving the flesh back to the mother and the bones back to the father, who are you then? But whether there is consciousness in that state, that's another question. Not names, not answers, but ability to be conscious without an object. That's what all those things are pointing to. So that's what the question is for, to maintain the sense of interest, consciousness.
Mm. Oh.
Or, unless you be as a man. So you got it together. You know, somebody asked Gampopa if it was true that women couldn't awaken. He said, oh hell no, that's not true. All they got to do is just be able to ask a question, you know, to get them to the point where they're less being and more questioning. Because you know how women are always relating everything to everything else. You know that. Have you noticed that? No?
Don't men do that too?
No, they usually go for the point. You ever had that conversation with a husband or a lover or anything, or sort of, you knew they were waiting for you to get to the point?
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Oh,
come
yeah.
on, ladies, let's be honest about this. We know that, don't we? And they're being patient with us because, you know they're supposed to. They might not get their dinner if they're not.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is this true or not? Yeah? Kathy's not talking to me today, but the rest of us were talking.
Oh, that book, Venus, that sort of thing.
I never read it, but is that sort of what
yeah,
it's talking about?
Thing, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, that was part of the survival, wasn't it? You have to be in your nest and be aware of everything around you, so you had to know, in relationship, the meaning to everything around you. And all the jewels of the male depended on you doing that well, you know, all his little, you know, his little genetic reproductions. You were the one looking after them.
Mm-hmm.
So he was out going, me go get one deer. She's going, what else beside deer is out here? What about it for you? Right? On the other hand. How else would we have survived? We wouldn't have. And it's still true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that's like when you're unconscious. If you're just following the urges of your being. If you're not also open to moving, transcending, transcending subject-object duality. That's if you're only caught in the duality, if you're still aware of position. And every path always talks about a state that transcends duality. In Buddhism, it's called awakening. So the Buddha is describing having had, as a male, having had a full experience of jhana to the nth degree, keeping the male then question arising in it. But he's going to get to that in a minute. I'm going ahead. Is this interesting?
Yes.
Because neither one is right. That's why in the Tibetan they have all those yabyam drawings.
And both are operating in our being, right? Just because
absolutely.
I'm female doesn't mean I don't.
No, not unless you just totally go unconscious and just shuffle your way through life. But the power of the union is in every one of us. Whether or not we will sing with it, open to it, get beyond our pride, or conceit, whatever you want to call it, of being a self. I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm equal to. You know? To get beyond that and actually say, and other than I, who else is home? If I leave cookies out, does somebody else eat? And you give your flesh back to your father and your bones back to your mother, who are you then? Or the other way around. But, you know, it's a good question. Yeah? If you're not identifying with duality, who are you then? So this is, so, okay, now I've talked too much, sorry. I saw that they were living at Benares in the Deer Park at Ishipatana. So that's okay, you've had your question answered, Pat, and we can go back to the sutra. And then it comes, 263, the teaching of the Dhamma, verse 25. Then because when I had stayed at Uruvela, as long as I chose, I set out to wander by stages to Benares. Between Gaya and the place of enlightenment, the Jivaka Upaka saw me on the road. So this is also, there's only, I haven't certainly read all of the Tipitaka, but I've seen this story also only in the Vinaya Pitaka. And it had slightly different connotations, but it's slightly different way of describing. But it's the same beautiful story, and you've heard me do my version of it many times in class, but it's nice for you to know where the actual stories come from. So the Ajiva Upaka saw me on the road and said, "Friend, your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess?" So now he's asking him, this one guy who's walking on the road in a different direction and meets the Buddha, he's saying, "What's your subject-object?" Isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Who's your teacher? Who do you study with? Right? So he's saying, who's your subject-object? Isn't he? You see that?
Mm-hmm.
I replied to the Ajivaka Upaka in stanzas. I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things. Isn't that lovely language? Unsullied among all things. I am one who is not caught by thinging. Renouncing all, by cravings ceasing, freed. There's no object and no subject, there's no craving. Having known this all for myself, to whom should I, having known this all for myself, to whom should I point as teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world, because there couldn't be two. There may very well be 20 Christs or 20 Buddhas at the same time, but there would only be one. I don't know if there may very well be many, but I know that whenever there is a Buddha or a Christ, there is only one. Because there is only the one state that, of that consciousness, or at-one-ment, or whatever you want to call it.
You're saying you're not really manifesting several bodies at all, one consciousness?
There is only one state. You find that often in Buddhism, it says attainment is at-one-ment with the Buddha. Okay? Therefore, no death, no birth. So you understand we're talking about transcendent experiences here in this whole little verse he's given. I have no teacher. One like me exists nowhere in all the world with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. I am the accomplished one in the world. I am the teacher supreme. I alone am a fully enlightened one whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I go now to the city of Kasi to set in motion the wheel of Dharma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless. So this guy says, oh, by your claims, friend, you ought to be the universal victor. And the Buddha says, the victors are those like me who have won to destruction of taints. I have vanquished all evil states. Therefore, Upaka, I am a victor. He's saying that that state is not different than me. So first he says, I am that state. Now he says, that state is not different from me. He's like saying, there is no duality. Because you got that, I'm sure. Am I just laboring a point because I think you didn't get it? Okay, I'm going on anyway. When this was said, and this is one of my favorite parts, the Ajivaka Upaka said, well, it might be, no, that, I guess that could be true. He says, oh, may it be so. No, may it be so, friend. And shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. You hear me tell that story, only I say, excuse me, I got to get the groceries home to my family or something. Oh, I hear you're a Buddha. Yes, that's right, I'm a Buddha. Oh, that's nice. Excuse me, I got to take the groceries home to my family. And would I be that different? I don't know. Something to think about, isn't it? Where are we going?
Well, he's shaking his head.
Yeah, exactly. But where are we going? Then bhikkhus wandering by stages. So that's rare that this story is told, so I just wanted to point that out to you. I only know it in the Vinaya Pitaka and in here. Doesn't mean that it isn't somewhere else and I haven't forgotten it. And I haven't read all of the Pitaka. Then bhikkhus wandering by stages, I eventually came to Benares, to the deer park at Ishipatana, and I approached the bhikkhus of the group of five. The bhikkhus saw me coming in the distance, and they agreed among themselves thus, friends, here comes that recluse Gotama who lived luxuriously, who gave up his striving and reverted to luxury. We should not pay homage to him or rise up for him or receive his bowl and outer robe, but a seat may be prepared for him. If he likes, he may sit down. However, as I approached, these bhikkhus found themselves unable to keep their pact. One came to meet me and took my bowl and outer robe. Another prepared a seat, and another set out water for my feet. However, they addressed me by name and as friend. So these are the five that he these are the five bhikkhus that practiced the austerities together, that practiced eating a grain of rice less every day for a long period of time, and not sleeping, and you know, not giving in, not drinking and not giving in to any desire, just training will only sort of thing. And then at a certain point, the Buddha said, oh, this isn't working, and he left. And they all went, quitter. So now he's coming back a little fatter than when he left. Thereupon I told them, bhikkhus, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. The Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. When this was said, the bhikkhus of the group of five answered me thus, Friend Gotama, his name again, by the conduct, the practice, and the performance of austerities that you undertook, you did not achieve any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Since you now live luxuriously, having given up your striving and reverted to luxury, not that we're judging, how will you have achieved any superhuman states and any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? When this was said, I told them, the Tathagata does not live luxuriously, nor has he given up his striving and reverted to luxury. The Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the deathless has been attained. And he carries on with the whole thing that was done on verse 27. I shall instruct you, and so forth. You could move from the home life. This is why all people go from the home life into homelessness. A second time, the bhikkhus of the group of five said to me, Friend Gotama, how will you have achieved any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? A second time I told them, the Tathagata does not live luxuriously, and the Tathagata has discovered why all you can move from the home life to the homeless. And you see, home life here is like actually being in a separate place. Right? And when you're in a home, that means you've got a door to close, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So he's talking about subject-object duality too, mm-hmm. Right? Into homelessness. A third time, the bhikkhus of the groups of five said to me, Friend Gotama, how will you have achieved any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones? When this was said, so the third time they asked the same question, then he addresses it differently. Then he says, bhikkhus, have you ever known me to speak like this before? No, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, the Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one. Listen, bhikkhus, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. I was able to convince the bhikkhus of the group of five. Then I sometimes instructed two bhikkhus while the other three went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those three bhikkhus brought back from their alms round. Sometimes I instructed three bhikkhus while the other two went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those two bhikkhus brought back from their alms round. Then the bhikkhus of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeking the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, they attained the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in them. Our deliverance is unshakable. This is our last birth. There is no renewal of being. So I want to just check that footnote. I think it's about the Four Noble Truths. that footnote?
314, is it? Stanza 29?
Yeah, 314. Thank you. At this point, the Buddha preached to them his first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the setting in motion of the wheel of the law, which is basically the Four Noble Truths on the Four Noble Truths. 2 weeks later, after they had all become stream enterers, he taught them the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the characteristics of non-self. So first the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Truth of Suffering. Noble truth of dissatisfactoriness. Right? Whatever is conditioned is dissatisfactory. Right? And they meditated on that, and they said, yep, that's true. And then the noble truth that there is a cause for dissatisfaction. And they meditated on that, and they said, yep, that's true. There is a cessation, whatever is causal, has ceases. There is a cessation to the dissatisfactory. Yep, that's true. And there is a path that you can follow that brings you to a great cessation. The Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. That's the Eightfold Path, it's the fourth one. And they said, okay, that's true. So they understood the fourfold teaching, and then he taught them the characteristics of no self, which is another whole teaching, and they all attained arahantship. The complete narrative found in the Mahavagga in the Vinaya is included in Jnanamoli's The Life of the Buddha, which is a little book that's quite interesting to read. Is that good? So while he was doing that and they were meditating on it for, you know, a period of time, some of them, they would alternate taking turns going out in alms round, but most of them were in quite a nice little retreat there for a while. It'd be nice to be at that retreat, eh?
So basically it's studying and practice. He taught them studying and practice.
How to hold the meditative and then bring the question in. It's basically calm and insight together. And you have to develop both. You can have as many questions or ideas or beliefs as you want, but unless your mind is in a place of non-possessiveness, non-position, open equanimity, you're not going to get an answer, are you? If it isn't a question, you're not going to be tranquil, are you?
Can you see that again?
If something is a question, there is an interest there. And if the mind is calm and there's an interest, you're going to look without bias.
Mm-hmm.
If the mind isn't calm, is frozen or caught or protective or, you know, possessive, then there is going to be a bias about your insight. It's going to be personal. So there isn't going to be an interest in a very deep way. And so that's the seven factors of enlightenment. Three active, three passive. Male and female. Awareness, center, neutral. Awareness is neutral. Neither active nor passive, nor not active nor not passive. Mount Meru. The unshakable. Is that good? Okay, so we're in the last part here. Sensual pleasure, my fave. Because there are these five courts. So now he's told them about these bhikkhus that he's been talking to, his story, and how he began teaching, right? Do you remember where this started? He was, Ananda had met some monks who said it would be really nice to hear the Buddha teach, right? So he has been telling his story of how he awakened to these monks that were kind of hoping the Buddha would drop by and give some teaching. And Ananda had suggested that he come by and they stay there that night and give him some teaching, right? And they had been talking about, gee, I wonder what the Buddha would teach, and he heard them. So he waited outside until they finished talking, and then he coughed politely. Remember that? So now he's told his story about how he got to where he is and how he taught it. And now he starts talking directly to them. Now he starts talking directly to them, what they should know. Bhikkhus, there are these five chords of sensual pleasure. So let's see the footnote there. 315. This section reverts to the theme of the noble and ignoble quests with which the Buddha's discourse opened. It is intended to show that the adoption of the monastic life is no automatic guarantee that one has embarked on the noble quest. Just because you're a monk doesn't mean you're noble. Yeah, we got that. Just because you're not a monk doesn't mean you're ignoble. Yeah, we got that. For the ignoble quest makes inroads upon the monastic life as well. Okay, we got that, right? What are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear would be the same lineup, that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual pleasure and provocative of lust. These are the five chords of sensual pleasure. So like the five senses. Five chords, aren't they? As to those recluses and Brahmins who are tied to these five chords of sensual pleasure, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, and who use them without seeing the danger in them or understanding the escape from them, it may be understood of them they have met with calamity, met with disaster. The evil man, one may do with them as he likes. That is illusion, Mara, delusion. They can be deluded. They can be ensnared in a trap. To go back to the trap one before. Suppose a forest deer who is bound laid down on a heap of snares. It might be understood of him he has met with calamity, met with disaster. The hunter can do with him as he likes, and when the hunter comes, he cannot go where he wants. So too, as to those recluses and Brahmins who are tied to these five cords of sensual pleasure, it may be understood of them they have met with calamity, met with disaster. The evil one may do with them as he likes. As to those recluses and Brahmins who are not tied to these five chords of sensual pleasure, who are not infatuated with them or utterly committed to them, and who use them, seeing the danger in them and understanding the escape from them, it may be understood of them, they have not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The evil one cannot do with them as he likes. So the ones who know how not to be trapped by the five senses are not subject to being trapped. If you know how to be restrained in seeing, you know when you find, if you look at certain things, you start going off on fantasies, right? Mm-hmm. You know that, then you're not trapped. You have it. You're not bound by it. The subject is not bound by the object. right?
Mm. So that is intangibles, would that be thoughts as well?
No, we're just talking about the five right now. We're not talking.
Okay.
We haven't gone that far yet.
Okay.
Okay. Suppose a forest deer who was unbound lay down on a heap of snares. It might be understood of him he has not met with calamity, not met with disaster. The hunter cannot do with him as he likes. And when the hunter comes, he can go where he wants. So too, so then here's this deer lying down on snares, but he's not actually bound by them. He can leave when he wants. So see how the Buddha is using that as the, it's not that you cut off your senses, because remember he tried that.
Mm-hmm.
He tried negating desire. You don't cut off your senses, but neither do you indulge them. So this is very much why Buddhism is called the middle way. You use them, but don't get snared by them. So too as to those recluses and Brahmins who are not tied to these five cords of sensual pleasure, it may be understood of them they have not met with calamity, not met with disaster, the evil one cannot do with them as he likes. Suppose a forest deer is wandering in the forest wilds. He walks without fear, stands without fear, sits without fear, lies down without fear. Why is that? Because he is out of the hunter's range. So too, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born from seclusion. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. In that state, he cannot be seen or caught by Mara, by delusion. Somebody who is using the five senses but not caught by them and turning the mind toward developing calm is not caught by Mara. Not only not feeding the desires and not caught by them, but teaching oneself how to dwell in a state that is calm regardless of what the senses are doing. That's blindfolding Mara, in the Buddha's words here. Is that lovely?
Mm-hmm.
This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, with the fading away as well of rapture, a bhikkhu abides in equanimity and mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So the third jhana has a very refined pleasure. The fourth jhana is equanimity. It moves beyond pain and pleasure. These are the formless form jhanas. Still within a self-awareness. A very refined, very beautiful state. Very lovely. Again, with the complete surmounting a perception of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, a Bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinity of space, infinite space, which is the fifth jhana or the first formless jhana. Nice descriptions, aren't they? This Bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, a Bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. So, developing the base of infinite space, then turning to see the consciousness that has that knowledge, then there is awareness of infinite consciousness. Turning around and looking at the mirror.
When they put like space is infinite in the quotation mark, and then again they put consciousness is infinite, is that implying that that's an intellectual statement?
No. It's
like as a thought, or a
there is an awareness, but not a thought. The awareness goes to an infinity of consciousness. And there isn't really a way to talk about it because these are the boundless states.
Yeah,
so it's like there's no longer a duality. There isn't an outer object. You do know it. You just don't know you know
it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a really strong sense, eh?
Yeah.
You just sort of like,
Yeah. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing. So it's just aware. And each awareness is like just a little more subtle or higher or low. I don't care which direction you take it. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of no-thingness. But you can see the subtlety in each one is just a slightly more subtle vibration. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara. Again, by completely surrounding the base of nothingness, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception, then goes beyond perception, or so surrounding, so like something that surrounds is something that transcends, right? Goes beyond. And I don't know how they found the words to say all these things. Abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to have become invisible to the evil one. So that's the fourth jhana. I'm sorry, that's the third jhana. Oh no, fourth jhana, neither perception nor non-perception. Wait, what am I on here? Yeah, so that's the third formless jhana. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhu is said to have... No, this is entering into the fourth one, yeah. Completely surrounding... this is going from the third to the fourth formless jhana. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara, to become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity. And then comes the insight part. Again, so here it is, the complete experience of the all eight jhanas, right? Which is the path that the Buddha is purported to have taken in order to awaken. He went through from the form jhana to the formless, from the formless back to the form, from the form back, in between the form and the formless, and then that state in between the two. Again, you got that in between the two. Then, again, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. and his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This bhikkhu is said to have blindfolded Mara to have become invisible to the evil one by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity and to have crossed beyond attachment to the world. He walks without fear, stands without fear, sits without fear, lies down without fear. Why is that? Because he is out of the evil one's reach. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that sutra, I think, takes a few readings. Shall we look up that footnote 318? Oh, that would have to do with the perception and feeling. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. You've heard me talk a lot, where there's a passion, there's a perception, where there's a perception, there's a passion, right? But they're not actually... Have you ever heard me say that?
Mm-hmm.
And then what do I say, but they're not actually... Any one perception is not actually locked to that feeling. You can say, oh, I love the Beatles, or oh, I hate the Beatles, and think that that's true. But really, there's the Beatles, and there's the hate and love, and they're not actually locked. You can change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Can't you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? They are not actually locked, but so long as there is this identifying with that, then there is continuously an I, isn't there? And then the maintaining of those views, right? So here it's talking about a bhikkhu enters upon, abides in the cessation of perception and feeling. Moves beyond. My beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche said the difference between an awakened being and an unawakened being is an awakened being gets 3 out of 2 and an unawakened being gets 2 out of 3. So, I think this is probably going to direct us to the introduction. This last, on the cessation of perception and feeling, see introduction, page 41. Because they did talk about this. Oh, I didn't think of it. Oh, look at that, I've got the, oh yeah. Came into the jhanas. On page 36 through 7, 3, 8, 3, 9. Page 41. There it is, a quarter of the way down the page, the second paragraph before the four planes of liberation start, right? Several sequences of meditative states mentioned in the Majjhima culminate in an attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling. Sanya Vedayitana Rodha Nirodha. Sanya, perception, Veda is feelings. And feelings, you know, Rupa Vedana Sanya. Like, dislike, physical, like, dislike, and neutral, mental.
Mm-hmm.
And Nirodha means cessation. Cessation of them is a one-link thing. Although this state always follows the last immaterial attainment, it is not, as it may be supposed, merely one step higher in the scale of concentration. Strictly speaking, the attainment of cessation pertains neither to serenity nor to insight. It is a state reached by the combined powers of serenity and insight, in which all mental processes are temporarily suspended. The attainment is said to be accessible only to non-returners and arahants. who have also mastered the jhanas and the immaterial states. And then in Majjhima Nikaya 43 and Majjhima Nikaya 44, there's detailed discussions of it. So we'll get there in about 2 years, I guess. Although we've been booming right along. But if you want to read in Majjhima 43 and 44, get ahead of the game, go for it. So, how's that? Interesting?
So, what did you mean? I mean, it's easy to say, but I'm not sure. Unenlightened people get two or three.
I didn't say that. My beloved teacher
yes.
said that.
Can you explain what that means?
I've got several explanations, but you'd have to ask him. Oh, he died.
Yeah. So
Bugger.
What was...
Who can you trust, you know?
How about one of your explanations?
If you always get two out of three, you're basically working with duality, aren't you?
Yep. But you're not right, or you are right, or...
But if you get three out of two, it can seem like there's duality and then there's transcendence.
Okay, that's what I thought.
That's what I thought. I didn't... He didn't describe it to me.
Okay.
I just
yeah.
went, you know, I had one of those aha moments when he said, you know, those aha moments
yeah.
that he used to have in his presence. Oh, come on, you had one or two, I watched you. Any other questions, answers, comments, complaints? It's a sutra that's worth reading a few times, you know. I mean, they all are, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of information in it. You don't very often find all eight jhanas just, you know, sort of like a little paragraph for each one, just kind of rolled down like that. Although, in the introduction, as I mentioned, on page 36, a writer, I can't remember his name, there's a monk who is also like, you know, my favorite Ayakema, who I had suggested that you read, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Ayakema, who is the self, and those other books,
mm-hmm.
where her path was the twice liberated, meaning jhana and insight together. There's a monk now who's been writing books that basically is talking about the same thing, and I haven't read any of his books yet, but I'm really interested, you know, to see what he has to say about it. It'll be an interesting thing to... Because it seems that was his path, too.
Do you recall his name?
No. But, you know, if you read any, you know, if you look at some of the Buddhist book dealers on the web, and you read descriptions, you'll see him and, you know, books by him. Some books by a man who talks about jhana and insight together. So it's nice to see that, you know, it's nice to see that starting to come back more of the broadness of the path that was taught in the time.
What was the name of that other person that you
were talking about? Ayya,
A-Y-Y-A.
K-H-E-M-A. And the book that I particularly recommend for her talking about how to work with jhana, how to develop jhana, and then use it for insight is called Who is the Self? Did you read that book? Did you any of you read that book?
I did.
It's worth reading, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. A lot of it I didn't understand, but it kept coming back to like stuff. Back to me.
Yeah, and I find too, if you read that book, that sometimes when you're doing a meditation and you think nothing much is happening, suddenly something will pop up and it'll be there and you'll just get it right away, because things are happening, but if you don't have it pointed out, it's hard to see it. You just think it's business as usual, which it is, but it's business as usual during alterations.
So the questions to that are the things that the five bhikkhus say, like, when they're talking about, well, how could you possibly have done anything because you don't have any supernormal powers and you can't do this and you can't walk on water, and you know, with that part of it where he first comes back to them. That's what a lot of the times it feels like. Like, just sitting there and you're going, oh, I can't make a day to appear in the day. You know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Like, not maybe quite so extreme, but there's that quality of feeling.
Yeah.
That this is just sitting here.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. Waiting, you know, waiting for, like...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Not waiting.
Yeah.
Just sitting.
And it's a very
just walking.
Strange kind
just
of
standing.
Feeling. Just
following.
To keep bringing the mind back to that. Just.
Yeah, let go of the past, let go of the future. Let go of becoming. You're always becoming. How do you ever get there? Or how do you know when you're there?
Yeah.
Or here. And all of the mystical traditions all say that. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Nice sutra, huh? You notice this beautiful gold light in your heart, so it spreads through your body. Goes out through the universe. Fills the whole world. Anybody in particular you're thinking of? Imagine them all. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. So thank you. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.